Our next case, which is case number 72778, Veterans and Politics International, and Mr. Sanson versus Marshall Willick and the Willick Law Group. The record will reflect that Justices Silver and Kadish have recused from participation in this case. The remaining five justices will be sitting, even though we all know Mr. Willick and Mr. Sanson, but under the duty to sit, we'll consider the case and proceed forward with it. So, Ms. Levy, do you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, 5 minutes, please.
5 minutes. Okay, we'll do so. You'll hear a little beep when you get to that point. Before we proceed, the amicus filed a reference to a case that the Supreme Court filed last week called Coker versus Sansone, 135 Nevada Advance Opinion Number 2. It was decided January 3, 2019. If either side, I know you haven't had a chance to brief the issue of that case, but if either side wants to argue about the impact of that case, feel free to do so, how it would affect the outcome of this one.
Thank you. I'm getting over a cold, so you'll forgive me if my voice gets scratchy at times.
We understand this time of year.
All right. May it please the court, I'm Annette Levy. I represent the appellant, Veterans in Politics, and its president, Steve Sanson. With regard to the Coker case, I just want to make a preliminary statement on that. I'm assuming that the court will now review this case de novo, so I was going to skip that issue for today, but if that's not the case, please let me know and I'd be happy to address
that. Wish to comment on it.
I completely agree with it.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Either side has a right to comment on it, even though it's not part of the briefs. The reason I mentioned that was normally we kind of restrict you to what's in the briefs, but here it's a brand new case, so you haven't had a chance to argue about it.
Thank you. This case can be summarized as follows. A lawyer's courtroom and law practice antics are not above rebuke. Lawyers should not be allowed to use their free access to the judicial system to bully and stifle journalists, media, and members of the public who criticize their professional conduct. My client is a journalist blogger. He works to expose wrongdoing in the courts and in government. He also lobbies on behalf of veterans. The respondent is probably the highest profile lawyer, family law lawyer, in Nevada. He has a history of suing people who comment and criticize and take issue with his professional conduct. We believe this case falls squarely within the Nevada anti-SLAPP statutes. We met both prongs of the anti-SLAPP statutes. With regard to the first prong, just by way of background, Mr. Sanson's being sued in connection with 5 written statements that he put online criticizing Mr. Willick's professional work. All of the statements were made in good faith. They were either true, substantially true, or constituted his opinions. But even if one or more of the statements are found to have been a false statement of fact, it doesn't matter because there's evidence that that was made in good faith without knowledge of the statement's falsity. And that is protected under the anti-SLAPP statutes. Second element of the first prong is public interest. All of the statements had to do with issues of public interest. For example, the use of veteran disability benefits to pay spousal support, lawyers overcharging their clients, lawyers using overzealous litigation tactics to chase an opponent to another state and keep them from going to law school, the location of sex offenders in the state, even at the law firm, the family law firm of one of the highest profile family lawyers here. All of these are of public interest. All of the statements were hyperlinked to their source materials. Those are court orders, court proceedings, legislative transcripts, radio shows in which Mr. Willick stated what he stated. That's all confirming information for whoever's reading the statement to look at that hyperlink, look at the source materials, and make up their own mind. all of the statements were made in the public forum, meeting the third element of the first prong, and that all of the statements were posted on the internet. With regard to the second prong, once we show that we prevail under the first prong of the anti-SLAPP statute, then the burden shifts to the plaintiff, in this case, Mr. Willick, to show with prima facie evidence a preponderance of prevailing on his claims. Here, there was no evidence submitted, let alone prima facie evidence, of any of the claims made by Mr. Willick. The only evidence submitted was a self-serving three-paragraph declaration that said that he agreed with everything in his own brief. The second piece of evidence he submitted was a statement from Mr. Sanson online, made online to a third party, saying that he agrees, that Mr. Sanson believes in what he wrote and invites the reader to please look at the documents that are hyperlinked. That shows good faith, and I thank Mr. Willick for bringing that forward. The next thing he submitted was a statement from Mr. Sanson asking for help with the litigation. That goes to no issue at all in the case. He sued for defamation, false light, business disparagement, and conspiracy. None of those pieces of evidence go to any of the elements in any of those claims. So as a matter of law, that second prong is met. I'd like the court to please reject the main arguments that Mr. Willick is making. Number one, that opinions are not covered under Nevada's anti-SLAPP statute. Opinions form the very basis of our free speech rights. To take that out of the protection of anti-SLAPP would be to gut the very statute itself. The legislature has made clear, the Constitution makes clear, that we want to give free speech the broadest protection possible. To take opinions out of it is to undermine the very democracy. Second of all, please reject the notion that what a lawyer does in court is none of the public's concern. What he does with his clients are none of the public's concern. And what he does with opposing counsel, how he behaves, is all of our concern. That's the truth of it. That's why we have the state bar that this very body governs. The state bar's very mission is to protect the interests of the public by regulating and supervising lawyers, both in and out of the courtroom. The last item I'd like the court to reject is that Mr. Willick is not a public figure. Mr. Willick lectures, writes books, sits on national committees, is on television, attests himself as the preeminent authority on family law in the state. There is little he can do to be a public figure that he hasn't already done. We've submitted a 10 or 11 page resume showing all of his work and being out there in the public. So he fits into the prongs of public figure. I'd like to now get into the more details of the case. With regard to the first prong, the first element of the first prong of the anti-SLAPP statute, the issue of good faith. Good faith is defined as truthful or made without knowledge of its falsehood. That's a statutory definition. These are the statements that are issued that are true statements. Richard Crane is a convicted sex offender. True. Richard Crane was working at the Willick Law Firm. True. Mr. Willick did not recover property for his client in the Holyoke case. True. Mr. Willick tried to get Ms. Holyoke pension benefits faster than she would otherwise have gotten it. True. Mr. Willick committed defamation against an opposing party in Virginia. True. Mr. Willick charged Ms. Holyoke about $100,000. Correct. He represented to the court that he was entitled to get a judgment for his fees and reduce it and grab her property to pay off his fees. That's true. And then we've got a substantially true statement. where Mr. Sampson wrote that Mr. Willick lost his appeal to the Supreme Court in the Holyoke case. All right, he didn't lose his appeal. What he lost was an attempted cross-appeal. Substantially true. Most people reading that don't know the difference between an attempted cross-appeal and an appeal. Mr. Willick spent about 40% of his brief, his answering brief in an appeal, trying to make an argument on an issue that was not the subject of the appeal. And the court refused to consider that because it said you didn't file a cross-appeal. So that statement is substantially true. Regarding opinions, opinions are words that are so imprecise that they don't lend themselves to an analysis of whether something is false or true. It's an opinion. It's I like the color red, or I don't like it, or, you know, Jesus looks red to me. It's something that means different things to different people. Therefore, it should be protected speech because under the anti-SLAPP statute, speech, the protected speech is one that is either true or said without knowledge of its falsity. Therefore, this was said without knowledge of its falsity since an opinion is not subject to a true or false analysis. Those statements in this case are words like, Mr. Willick is a hypocrite, he scams his client, he screws over veterans for profit and power, his work is not worth $100,000. Who's not entitled to their opinion on what a lawyer's work is worth? We even teach our children, hey, everybody's entitled to their opinions. That's why it's protected. It also covers ambiguous statements. In this case, statements like the January 12, 2017 statements in which Mr. Sampson stated that Willick and his pal convicted of sexual malfeasance committed defamation per se in Virginia. That statement was missing two commas. It was grammatically imperfect. Free speech doesn't just cover grammatically perfect, professionally proofread speech. It covers speech that's made in good faith. Two missing commas that are corrected and clarified two times within 6 days of publication, well before the 20-day statutory requirement that says that you have to, if you want to shield yourself from certain liability, you have to issue a retraction or clarification within 20 days of demand. Here was 6 days of publication, no demand before the lawsuit was even issued. And he tried to do that twice. He submitted a declaration saying that he did not mean to imply that Mr. Willick was a sex offender in that. And certainly, the statement was hyperlinked to the court document. So even if it was an ambiguous statement because of two missing commas, anyone could read the hyperlinked court documents and to see for themselves what the statement was.
You're down to just a little over 3 minutes. Did you want to reserve that time for the rebuttal?
No, I'm going to, I think I'll go ahead and talk about public interest real quick. Can I, I'll reserve 2 minutes, is that right?
Okay, but keep an eye on the clock.
I will. On public interest, the case law specifically says that what a lawyer does in the courtroom and in other areas, such as the legislative proceedings, are matters of public interest. We cited to all that case law in our briefs. Here, the respondents are officers of the court. They, I want to also skip first, given the time limits, that under Pegasus, under the test of Piping Rock Partners, there are five factors under that test to determine whether something is in public interest. First of all, it has to be not a mere curiosity, but in fact affect a large number of people. Here, again, all of the issues that I rattled off earlier on affect a large number of people, Social Security disability benefits, lawyer overcharging, lawyer screwing over clients chasing, being overzealous in their actions with opposing counsels. So it all fits the five factors. Case law says that lawyers, what they do is of public interest. And, in fact, we have numerous cases also that show that if you're a public figure, certainly certainly that heightens the public interest. So with that, I'll reserve the remaining time.
Ms. Levy, I have two questions.
Yes.
Were there any other corrections tendered by your client to any of the statements other than the one that you mentioned earlier?
No.
And with respect to the one that was published, or maybe there were a couple published corrections, I don't want you to burn up your time here answering this, but could you leave with the clerk the record site of those corrections?
Yes.
It's in the record.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I did leave them in the brief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, Ms. Levy, we'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
It went under a minute, but we'll give you the 2 minutes you requested.
Thank you.
We'll give Mr. Gilmore an additional minute. So.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Joshua Gilmore on behalf of the respondents, Mr. Willick and the Willick Law Group. This is before the court. Appeal from an order denying an anti-SLAPP motion brought in a case against Mr. Sanson, who spewed false and defamatory information across the internet about Mr. Willick. Most incredibly, the representation that now lives in infamy on the internet that he was convicted of sexual coercion of a minor. Now, Mr. Sanson sought relief below under the anti-SLAPP statute. He filed a motion.
You haven't had a case where a statement potentially defamatory like the one you just mentioned was corrected prior to the time that the 20-day demand notice would usually be applicable in the context of an anti-SLAPP statute. Would you care to comment on that and how the district court should approach an anti-SLAPP motion? Should it address the correction as part of that assessment?
The answer is no, Your Honor, and here's why. The first prong.
Why wouldn't we insulate publishers of defamatory actions who make demands for corrections? Indeed, there is a prerequisite for such a demand before you can sue. In this instance, the correction was made before the demand. So why wouldn't one evaluate the statement on the basis of the correction that had been made?
You would under the second prong of the anti-SLAPP analysis, but we never got there, and we don't get there today as well. And one of the crucial points I want to make this morning is the First Amendment is not synonymous with the anti-SLAPP statute. They serve different purposes. The First Amendment is a substantive defense at times to claims based on certain types of speech. The anti-SLAPP statute is a procedural device, nothing more than that. And if certain speech forms the basis of a claim that is brought against an individual, it may give a defendant an opportunity to bring a motion to dismiss. But just because speech falls within the anti-SLAPP statute, and specifically NRS 41637, doesn't mean it is or it isn't protected under the First Amendment. You get to that analysis once the burden shifts to the plaintiff. So in response to Your Honor's question, the clarification does not come up during the first prong of the anti-SLAPP analysis. In fact, the analysis is much simpler than that. This court and the trial court looks at
the... Well, that seems odd to... We insulate people from defamatory actions who make corrections, and yet we wouldn't afford that same recognition in the context of an anti-SLAPP statute motion?
You may if you get to the second prong. So that is a defense to the claim itself.
Was that considered by the judge with respect to the second prong in this case?
It was not because the district court did not get to the second prong. And we know as recently from the Coker versus Sassone decision that was issued about 10 days ago, you don't get to the second prong if the defendant does not meet its initial burden of proof under the first prong. Now, that doesn't mean that this defense is gone forever. They will raise it, and in fact, they have raised it under a 12B5 motion, or they may raise it under 56. But they don't get to raise it under the anti-SLAPP statute if they can't meet their initial burden of proof. So under NRS 41660, It is first the defendant's obligation to come forth with evidence to say that the claims brought against me arise from communications as defined under NRS 41637. And this court has said several times, we don't take, for example, good faith, take it out of the statute and apply a different definition. In the DeLucci case, this court said that phrase does not operate independently. You look to NRS 41637, and in this case, we are focused on subsection 4, a communication made in direct connection with an issue of public interest in a public forum or in a place open to the public that is true or is made without knowledge that it was false. So, what happens below? The Honorable Judge Thompson takes up this motion. Here's the evidence. Here's the arguments made. And one of the crucial things that I argued below was that these are merits-based defenses that you are raising during the first prong of the analysis. And we hear it today as well, and it's in the briefs. You can't conflate the first and second prong of the anti-SLAPP analysis. Those are two different steps. We know under Patton versus Lee, which was issued late last year by this court, 134 Nevada, Advanced Opinion 87, you don't raise an affirmative defense during the first prong of the anti-SLAPP analysis. The clarification that you ask about is an affirmative defense to a defamation claim. But we don't get there.
But Mr. Gilmore, why don't we get there? And you have five statements, even the first one, for instance, which is a comment upon a public interview Mr. Willett gave. It's your position that if someone goes in public, goes on radio, makes commentary, that no one else can comment on that? That's not in the public interest?
So, yes, Your Honor, our answer is that is not a matter of public interest, and here's why. So Judge Thompson and this court, conducting its own de novo review, looks at the statement. Now, we can't have an amorphous public interest and attempt to attach that to the statement. And I would direct this court to review the Commonwealth case out of California, that is 1 Cal Reporter 3D 390, where the court says, here's what we do when we really are trying to ascertain whether a communication involves a matter of public interest. The court there said we focus on the speech in particular, and we do not abstract generalities from that speech, because it's easy for a defendant to go back and say, well, here's really what I was talking about. This is what I meant to say. The court, as Judge Thompson did here, and I urge this court to look at these statements as well, say if you look at this statement, is he talking about something more than Mr. Willick? And if you look at all five statements, because he went to court and stands here today saying all five statements involve matters of public interest, they do not. He is focusing on Mr. Willick. This case might be different if that post was part of a larger expose or discussion.
And if you could address something, in Shapiro we set forth some factors to consider as to whether or not it's public interest. Can you talk about those a little bit?
I would, Your Honor. And Shapiro, two of the factors, the fourth factor says we focus on the speech in particular, right? And again, you look at that, and I think that's what the California case is saying. And when we look at the speech here, and I'll jump to the Holyoke quotes, for example. He's talking about Mr. Willett. That's all he's doing. This is not a discussion about overzealous lawyers or lawyers who overbill their clients, where he might say that's a matter of public interest. He's talking about a private divorce case. Yes, it is in a public courtroom, but there is no evidence that that case meant something more than it did to the two litigants involved in that case. And one of the Shapiro factors said you can't turn something that's a matter of private issue between two parties into a public interest simply by virtue of publishing it to a lot of individuals. The other comment I would make, Your Honor, is you look at VIPI and what its mission is. It's out there touting to the public that we vet judicial candidates. That's what they do. So its audience, its email list, the people that it speaks to, turn to VIPI for information on judicial candidates. Statements about Mr. Willick, he's not running for judicial office. These are not posts directed to people who follow Vippy. In furtherance of, should I vote for this individual? Should I vote for that individual? Turning to the first post about veterans, it's not a post explaining why the legislation was bad for veterans. It's not a post saying, here's an example of Mr. Willick taking advantage of veterans. Not only that, and we mentioned to Judge Thompson below, this was old news. It was not an ongoing discussion. And the California cases, and we cite them in our brief, say, if you're not publishing to a huge audience, if it's a targeted audience, in this case, Vicky's followers on social media and email, then it's got to be part of an ongoing discussion.
But, sir, you're suggesting that someone, Mr. Willick went on a radio show. Presumably, public listens to the radio. You're suggesting that no one can comment and give their opinion about what he said on the radio? That that's somehow not a public, a matter now of public interest that Mr. Willick made, his comments he put out to the world, that no one can comment on those?
I'm not urging this court to find that no one can comment on.
So why aren't those statements of opinion about what Mr. Willick put out to the public himself? How are those, just on one, each one of these statements needs to be analyzed individually.
I agree.
Okay. How is statement one not meet the first prong?
The first statement doesn't meet the prong because there is no public interest in legislation that passed 18 months ago. And if you look at that post, he doesn't explain what's good about it or what's bad about it.
But he's commenting on Mr. Willick's comments about it.
So he's targeting one individual, correct? So I'd urge this court to find that you have to speak about something more.
One individual who went on the radio to talk about it.
That's correct. And for it's Vippy's radio, we don't have any evidence to know what the listening audience is for that radio. But it is on the radio. I certainly say that. And I draw this court's attention back to the Commonwealth Energy Court case, where the court said, in the case before us, hawking an investigatory service is not an economics lecture on the importance of information for efficient markets. So the issue there, they were trying to expand it into something more than what was really going on. And that's what we had here. And that's why Judge Thompson looked at this and said, these five statements, they don't involve a matter of public interest. As this court has told us to look under Shapiro following the Piping Rock analysis. Now the other arguments we make are, well, these are consumer warnings. These are consumer warnings that we're giving to the public. But again, Vippy is not advocating out there about lawyers that people should or should not hire. And these posts don't appear, for example, on Avvo, where you would say, well, somebody would turn to this website or this social media platform.
So would the same statements be fine on Avvo or on Yelp? In your estimation, they're fine on that forum, but they would not be fine on Vippy's forum?
I think you have to look at it in context, Your Honor.
You mentioned Avvo.
Yes.
So in the context of Avvo, same statements you said would be fine if they're on Avvo.
I think you would look at that, and if it's on Avvo or a website directed to consumers looking to hire lawyers, you'd have a stronger argument that it would fall under the public interest. But again, you have to look at all five factors here, and irrespective of that, I'd still submit that if you are simply targeting one lawyer rather than having a broader discussion, saying to people, look out for lawyers like this. And again, we have to focus on the speech that it is before us rather than after the fact say the public has an interest in overzealous lawyers. The public has an interest in lawyers who overbill their clients. But remember, too, it's...
You don't think that isn't a public interest?
It is a public interest, but it's the exact kind of amorphous public interest that is not sufficient when you're arguing for...
Why can't a speaker in a public forum or in their own forum cite as an example support for overzealous billings?
You are free to put that on the internet, which is what they did.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's actionable comes under the second prong of the anti-slap. But initially, when we're talking about... I'm sorry?
How is the statement false? Ms. Levy went through a whole list of portions of that statement. Is there any statement she made that's false?
We
dealing with that statement?
And this would be the first statement on the veterans, Your Honor?
No. The statements dealing with the billing in the Holyoke case.
There's no
statement she made in court at that podium characterizing the statement that was false.
That he scammed his client, absolutely. That he made misrepresentations to this court. Those are serious charges. We have no evidence to show the misrepresentation. And it takes you to the second element of the statute, which is truth. He has to come forward to prove that each of these statements is true. Now, they talk about some. There's no evidence before this court that Mr. Willick was convicted of sexual coercion of a minor. There's no evidence before this court that he was found guilty of defamation. There's no evidence before this court that he made misrepresentations to this court in the Holyoke case. And there's no evidence that he lost the case for his client in Holyoke. In fact, Judge Thompson observed Mr. Willick prevailed on appeal. So the issues I understand that you're asking about, Justice Hardesty, but we will get there when this matter is resolved on a 12B5 motion. But if somebody wants relief under the anti-SLAPP statute, it's harder to get there because there are benefits that don't...
So let me just clarify one other question because we're running out of time here. Is it your position that a communication that is an opinion, the judge makes an assessment of the statement and the statement is found to be an opinion, is not protected by the anti-SLAPP statute motion?
That, it depends on the statement itself.
Under prong one.
I'm sorry?
Under prong one.
The court doesn't have
good
to determine...
Good faith opinion. You have to determine whether it's an opinion or a statement of fact.
You do not have to determine whether it's an opinion. And one of the arguments we made...
Isn't that contrary to the legislative history behind the anti-SLAPP statute, which said, we, at least in my view, which said that you want to prevent people from being sued who are expressing opinions or statements that are protected, that are in good faith and are truthful or made with reasonable belief that they are truthful. Isn't the judge's responsibility to first assess whether the statement that they're looking at is one of opinion or one of fact?
You get there under the second prong, Your Honor, I would submit.
Where in the anti-SLAPP statute do you see that?
Under NRS 41-66.
Is that in the definition of the word communication in the statute or someplace else that I'm not aware of?
Communication beyond the word communication is not
That's
further
right.
defined under the statute.
That's
that
right.
is correct, Your Honor.
So should we, in this case, define communication?
I don't think you need to do that, Your Honor. I think it is much more simpler than that. We continue to use the definition that the legislature has given us and the Shapiro factors that this court has provided.
So why would we, as a matter of policy, consistent with the legislative history that was that formed the basis of the anti-SLAPP statute and at least two amendments since then, require somebody who states an opinion to continue to participate in a defamation case when it can be defended as an opinion, it was never a statement of fact from the beginning?
I would say that's a matter that the legislature would have to take up, Your Honor, to expand the definition of what's intended to be within the anti-SLAPP
statute. Don't we have to do that in this case by assessing what a communication is?
I think you can look at these statements here, Your Honor, and I see I've run out of time, so if I
please
I
go ahead and
continue
answer,
to
the
answer the question. I think all this court needs to do here, you don't have to engage in a complex First Amendment analysis, which is what that entails. When trying to figure out if something is an actionable opinion, if it's a mixed statement of law and fact, because we know opinion is not just wholesale exempt from defamation law, because it can imply the existence of defamatory facts. That is true. The U.S. Supreme Court has told us that. But that analysis happens under the second prong. And what I was saying at the beginning is, whether something is actionable or not, you get there after you get through the first prong of the anti-SLAPP analysis. These issues that are being raised ultimately were never addressed by Judge Thompson, and I would urge that would not be for something for this court to address in the first instance on appeal from an order denying an anti-SLAPP motion under the first prong.
But isn't the determination of whether the statement is a communication, is an opinion or a statement of fact or mixed, a question of law?
That would be a question of law that is conducted under the second prong, Your Honor. That is correct. I think just for the first prong and the issue that is before this court today, is addressing whether these communications satisfy the definition of NRS 41-637-4. And if we do, then the parties move forward with the second prong. But that would be something I submit would have to happen in the district court, particularly here where evidentiary objections were not ruled on below. And it is not, this court is a fact finder. It doesn't make evidentiary rulings in the first instance. If there's nothing further, I submit it on the briefs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Levy, you have 2 minutes. So.
I honestly don't know where Mr. Gilmore got the notion that certain facts and certain characterizations of speech only apply to a second prong or only apply to a 12b-5 motion. The statute says good faith. Good faith is shown when someone corrects a statement. That's good faith. It may also be a defense, a statutory defense for a defamation claim, but what you look at is the actions to determine good faith, and that's a true statement or a statement made without knowledge of its falsity. There is absolutely nothing provided in this record and everything provided to the contrary to show that any of these statements were made knowing that they were false, and that the very fact that an opinion is not subject to a falsity analysis, so it cannot possibly have been made with knowledge of its falsity. How can that not be covered under the first prong of the anti-SLAPP statute? Nevada bases its anti-SLAPP statutes and cases and analysis on California's. Both states have some of the broadest protections for free speech. And to say that you can't cover opinions or gee, this falls only under the second prong, even though it applies to the first, makes sense under the first, and G put it under a 12b-5 motion where you have no immediate appeal to the Supreme Court, you have to get dragged out through the entire case, where it's not a summary judgment type of proceeding, and it doesn't get rid of all the claims. Of course, the plaintiff wants you to adopt that kind of a notion because that would alleviate the ability to not be bullied into being stifled. So, that much, I saw no cases on that point at all, and it doesn't make any logical sense, any policy sense, or otherwise. I've got only a few more seconds, but consumer warnings, you don't have, cases that deal with consumer warnings do not look at whether you're an Avo, whether you're a Yelp. They look to the substance of the statement, and we've got cases on that, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Levy. Okay, thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments and briefs, and we will take this case under submission. We'll be in recess today.